Welcome to Remarket. This is our staff-generated podcast of some of our favorite things from the week. I'm Deborah Clark. I'm the executive producer. So this past week, perhaps a little conversation with the president.
It was, you know, we had nothing to do on
Wednesday.
I'm
sorry. Who are you?
Hi. Kai Rizdal,
why are you in my podcast?
The better question is, why are you in my studio? But I guess, you know, since you're my boss, I have to let you. But go ahead.
Okay. So I thought we could have a little chat about what went into the Obama visit that we did on Wednesday. We went out to, well, set the scene for us. Where'd we go?
Well, hold on. Well, let's back up, because we've been trying to get the president, as has every media outlet in this country, for the past 3.5 years. You know,
right.
We call once a month and say, hey, it's Marketplace. We'd like to talk to the president. They called us back and they said, if you can be in Nevada at 1:40 on Wednesday, you can have 15 minutes of his time. And we said, okay.
So we flew out there, you, me, and our engineer, Jeff Peters,
to the Copper Mountain Solar Facility, which is, as it sounds, a bajillion square feet of solar panels.
It was unbelievable. It was like fields and fields.
Well, let's talk about how you get ready for a presidential interview, right? Here's what it looked like from my end.
And maybe I don't know how I get ready.
I've never done it before, but here's what happens. Everybody and their dog says, ask him this. No, ask him this. No, ask him this. No, ask him this. No, ask him this. Let's ask him this. And I said, my head's going to explode if you people keep talking.
Luckily, I get to decide.
Sadly, no. You always think that. But the words are coming out of my mouth.
So, okay. So what we did do is we figured out that in 15 minutes, we weren't going to have time for more than...
I think five-ish, right?
Five-ish, yeah, with some follow-ups. Yeah. And so we knew we had to talk about energy because that was part of the interview. It's where he was. We also obviously talk about jobs and the economy a lot, so we knew we needed something along those lines. And then we thought we would use the opportunity right ahead of the SCOTUS discussions this week on the healthcare stuff to talk about healthcare. So we were sort of working with that, right?
And yeah, we had a game plan. We had 5 to 7 questions roughed out, and it went almost exactly according to plan in the moment. And, you know, I made the one mistake in this entire operation, which is I asked a follow-up that went kind of sideways, and that cost us 3 minutes of our 15, which meant we couldn't ask the president about housing. So next
time. Which was a shame in particular, considering that we were in Vegas and, you know, scene of many worse foreclosure crisis in the country, et cetera. But, you know, I think it turned out well. The other regret I have, though, is that we didn't actually have a fun kicker. I had this I had this fantasy that we'd have an Al Green moment where we would get something that nobody – it could be singing. It could be a poem. I don't care. Whatever.
Yeah. But, you know, we did all right.
Yeah. I heard him – thank you for your service.
Yeah. He had been well briefed, right? So he knew about my military service. Mm-hmm. He knew about my diplomatic service. He is personable. He's relaxed. He's relaxing. He put me completely at ease. I mean, it was a great couple of minutes, and then the interview started.
Which it will now.
Mr. President, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You were talking about your all-of-the-above energy strategy.
Right.
But I wonder whether Americans aren't more interested in a one of the above energy strategy, and that is gas not at $4 a gallon.
Well, look, ultimately what Americans care about is the huge burden that it's placing on families right now. If you have to drive 50 miles to work, and I hear from a lot of folks who do, then this is a real strain on budgets. So their most immediate concern is gas prices. But it's interesting, when you talk to Americans across the country, what they also realize is that there's no silver bullet. They want to make sure that we've got strong oil and gas production, and they're glad to hear that we're starting to make progress on natural gas, on additional oil production here in the United States. They also understand that if we've only got 2% of the world's oil reserves and we're using 20% of the world's oil, then the math is not going to add up unless we also develop the kinds of new technologies that are represented by this solar panel field out here.
Acknowledging there's no silver bullet, you get criticized by Republicans on their campaign trail. Your response has been, we're drilling as much as we can, more oil than at any time in the past 8 years. Is there more you can do so that it doesn't cost $55 to fill up your tank?
Well, the main reason that you're seeing the kind of gas spike that we're seeing right now has to do with uncertainty in the Middle East. So a lot of this has to do with the risk premium that's being tacked on. People aren't certain about what's going to happen with Iran. There's also been some tightening in the market because some unlikely places like Sudan and Yemen, they may only produce 100,000 barrels or 200,000 barrels, but when you add it all up, you've seen about 1 million barrels taken off the market. And what that means is that even if we're producing as fast as we can, we're still not going to see gas prices where we'd like them to be, unless we're also focused on being more efficient with the oil and gas that we have. So as you said, we're producing more than any time in the last 8 years. We've actually reduced oil imports to under 50%, and they're as low as they've been in a long time over the last couple of years. What we now need to do is open up additional sites for drilling, and we're doing that. We're actually, even on public lands, we've increased permitting by about 13%. But what we've also got to do is double fuel efficiency standards on cars. We're slated right now by the next decade to see fuel efficiency standards go up to 55 miles a gallon. That can save families about $8,000 during the lifetime of a car. We're going to have to make sure that we're using oil in our businesses a lot more efficiently. So if we add improved production with increased efficiency, then over time we can regain control over our energy supplies.
With all respect, it was kind of a gutsy move, I think, to come to a solar facility. Your administration has staked a lot on clean technology, green jobs. The biggest item most people know about that strategy is, of course, a company named Solyndra, which your administration gave loan guarantees to that then went bankrupt and has been the subject of many investigations. Are you doing your all-of-the-above strategy right if that's what we have to show for it, Solyndra?
We are doing the all-of-the-above strategy right. Obviously, we wish Solyndra hadn't gone bankrupt. Part of the reason they did was because the Chinese were subsidizing their solar industry and flooding the market in ways that Solyndra couldn't compete. But understand, this was not our program per se. Congress, Democrats and Republicans, put together a loan guarantee program because they understood historically that when you get new industries, it's easy to raise money for startups. But if you want to take them to scale, oftentimes there's a lot of risk involved. And what the loan guarantee program was designed to do was to help startup companies get to scale. And the understanding is that some companies are not going to succeed. Some companies will do very well. But the portfolio as a whole ends up supporting the kind of innovation that helps make America successful in this innovative 21st century economy. Do I wish that Solyndra had gone bankrupt? Absolutely not. And obviously it's heartbreaking what happened for the workers who were there. When you look at the overall portfolio, is it right for us to make sure that we're not just cashing in our chips and letting the Chinese or the Germans develop the technologies that we know are going to be critical in the future? I'm proud to say that we're going to continue to support it.
You said when you were campaigning in 2008, you were going to spend $150 billion on green tech and clean energy and create 5 million clean energy jobs. You didn't get there.
Well, we haven't gotten there partly because this thing interceded called the Great Recession. We had the worst financial crisis and the biggest drop in employment and the housing market. Obviously, the bottom fell out of it. And so we've spent a lot of time digging our way out of that hole. Part of it has been a clean energy strategy and investments that we made because of the Recovery Act, the investments that are being made as we speak, help to account for the kind of solar facility that we're seeing right here that is creating jobs right here in Boulder City.
Let me ask you about the labor market. Unemployment is down from its high during this administration. It's now 8.3%. There are still millions of people, though, unemployed. Long-term unemployment is becoming a structural problem in this economy as people lose the skills. What more can you do and what more should the government do to create jobs in this economy?
Well, there are a bunch of things we should be doing. You're right. We've made progress. The fact is that over the last 24 months, we've created almost 4 million jobs. We've seen more growth in the manufacturing sector than any time since the 1990s, about 400,000 jobs created over the last couple of years. And so the trend lines are good, and one of the most important things that we needed to do was to make sure the economy was growing. But you're right that we still have way too many people unemployed. There's still some headwinds that we've got to deal with. I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, the housing market's still probably the biggest drag on the economy. Now, what we've done administratively is allow people to start refinancing their homes to take advantage of historically low rates if their mortgages are held by one of the FHA programs, mm-hmm. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The problem is that that only captures a portion of people who could be refinancing, saving $3,000, putting more money into the economy and creating more jobs and getting the construction industry back up and running. So we've called on Congress to make a change that would allow everybody to refinance right now. That's something that would create jobs. Second example. Infrastructure. We've got a couple of $1 trillion worth of improvements that need to be made right now all across the country. Interest rates have never been lower. Contractors have never been more desperate for work. construction workers are idle at home when they want to be working. For us to engage in embark on a major infrastructure development program right now not only would put people to work as we speak, but it would also pay huge dividends in terms of economic growth over the long term. So the issue here is not that there aren't things we can do to put people back to work, retrain them for the jobs that currently exist. The challenge is that Congress is going to have to think a little more boldly than they have been and get past some of the partisan name-calling that has become a habit in Washington. If we do, then there are a bunch of things that we can do to put people back to work.
Let me use that as a pivot then and ask you about the Republicans who are currently campaigning for your job. I don't know if you watched TV last night after the Illinois primary. I'm sure you got a briefing this morning. Both Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum made the case that their platforms of economic freedom are the way to go. They say you're not doing enough. They say you haven't been doing enough. You shrug, but that's, you know, I mean, you know what they're saying. So the question is, make this close the sale, right? Because you keeping your job in November is going to be depending on how people feel about whether you did it or you didn't do it as you promised 3.5 years ago.
Look, you know, I think at a time when people are still out there struggling around the country, where unemployment is still too high and a lot of folks are still worried about their mortgage, their home being underwater, nobody, I think, can claim that we are where we want it. But I think when the American people think back to the last 3 years and where we've been and where we're moving towards now, when you ask them what has more likelihood of succeeding, a policy in which we're providing additional tax cuts to the very wealthiest Americans, who are the only folks who've benefited from any significant income growth over the past decade, stripping away regulations that help keep our air and water clean, defunding things like education that we know are going to help us to be competitive. When you ask them, is that a recipe for long-term economic growth, their answer is going to be no. And when you turn to them and say, should we be investing in school reform that puts more money in but also demands greater accountability and makes sure that we're investing in teachers? Should we be rebuilding our infrastructure? Should we be investing in clean energy technology? Should we be investing in basic research and science? And should we pay for that and get our deficit under control with a balanced approach that gets rid of programs that don't work, but is also making sure that folks like me are paying our fair share of taxes? Then that's the recipe that they have a lot more confidence will allow us to be competitive in the 21st century. So, the debate is going to be joined. I think it's going to be a healthy one. But the fact is, we've tried what they're peddling. We tried it in the decade before the financial crisis. Shoot, we tried it before the decade before the Great Depression. And historically, that recipe, that sort of on-your-own economics that is now being warmed over in this campaign, has not been a recipe for American greatness and American economic success.
Mr. President, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay, so that was the interview that ran on the PM show that day. We also ran a couple of things about the healthcare decision on our morning report the following morning.
Friday, as I'm sure you know, is the second anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, your healthcare law. It goes before the Supreme Court on Monday for a what you can only call a marathon hearing. I wonder, as you look at a country that still is divided over that law, if there's anything you'd have done differently to be in this place now, getting ready to enact it with more of a mandate, with more popular support.
Well, I would have loved to have gotten it done quicker, which is part of the reason why we designed a program that actually previously had support of Republicans, including the person who may end up being the Republican standard bearer and is now pretending like he came up with something different. It is a program that says we're going to continue to have a private marketplace for health care, but we're going to allow consumers to pool their resources. We're going to make sure consumers are protected, and we're going to make sure that if folks don't currently have insurance, that they've got a means of doing it at a reasonable rate.
Let me ask you the follow-on question then about the Supreme Court on Monday. Yeah. Assuming, as I'm sure you do, that you will prevail in the Supreme Court with the case over the individual mandate, you will have beaten in court 26 states. That is the majority of states. You will have to depend on them to execute your plan to reform the healthcare system in this country, and yet they will be unwilling and unwelcome partners. Are you confident you can still get it done even after all this acrimony?
Absolutely, because frankly, these lawsuits that were filed were basically uniformly filed by Republicans who wanted to score political points And even some of those who filed suit are actually behind the scenes working with us to prepare for a day where we've got exchanges in these states where people can be part of a larger pool so they can get a bit better deal on their insurance. And it will be very hard to for any governor to explain why it is that they're not giving people and small businesses, not just individuals, an opportunity to get cheaper health insurance, better deal, more protections, because of some ideological argument that they're having with the president. And when people see that, in fact, it works, it makes sense, as it's, by the way, working in Massachusetts, then I think a whole bunch of folks will say, why aren't we trying it as well? And, you know, historically, when you look at the history of Social Security, when you look at the history of Medicaid, some of the same controversies have come up, some of the same resistance has come up. But ultimately, when people actually saw that it was helping them, helping their lives, when young people right now find out that 2.5 million young people are getting health insurance who didn't have it because they can stay on their parents' plan, or when seniors learn that, you know what, this is actually helping me reduce my cost of prescription drugs, or families and small businesses realize they're in a better position to get health care. You know, over time, as it gets implemented, I think people will say this was the right thing to do.
Pretty hard to top a week that involves a visit with the president, I must say. However, we did also have a great week with Marketplace Money, our weekend show. We did our semi-annual collaboration with the New York Times. This one was called The Comeback Chronicles, and it was a look at how people have fared well, not the usual bleak stories that we tell, but how people have fared well since the recession, people who got hit, who've actually come back and done pretty well. So there were some really good tales. Tess Vigeland, our money host, got a couple of bylines in the New York Times, including a print version of this story that you're about to hear. She traveled to Detroit and met a couple of folks who've done some things differently with their life since the economic downturn.
Okay, go on.
Kurt Edwards, the 49-year-old former warehouse worker.
How you doing, Mr. Brown?
I'm okay.
Okay, that's good. Okay, I'm just coming in here to check on you and see how everything is going today.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Today, he's a licensed practical nurse working the graveyard shift at Sheffield Manor Nursing Home, tending to the elderly, the infirm, and mentally ill in a ramshackle neighborhood on Detroit's west side.
Medicine and all that was passed?
Everything is lovely.
Okay. And I'll be coming back in, and we're going to take care of all this, fix everything up, and we're going to get...
Edwards was divorced with no children when A&P laid him off. For months, he paid daily visits to job boards at Michigan Works, a local development agency. He wouldn't even have considered nursing until someone he was dating suggested the idea.
So I'm not going to nursing school. That's for women. I'm looking at trucking, and I said, I could be a truck driver. I'm looking at all these manual labor positions. Then I said, wait a minute, I'm getting kind of older to be doing manual labor. That's when I said, you know what? It can't be that hard if these women are doing it.
Hey.
He didn't have a penny saved, but he decided to go back to school. Living on unemployment checks plus the odd grocery delivery from his mother while studying math and biology. A now-defunct worker training program paid for the one-year accelerated nursing school program, but the workload was such that he couldn't take a job while studying, so he spent the last 4 months of school with no electricity in his apartment because he couldn't pay any bills except the rent. Edwards graduated in 2010 and now makes $20,000 more than he did at the warehouse.
You kind of pinch yourself because you take off in a direction, you have this plan, you have this goal. I was going to be at this warehouse. I was part of the middle class, and I was going to make it. Everything was going just fine. And then you look up one day, and everything has just stopped. So when you take a chance, I'm going to say take a chance and do something different, and it turns out all right, you're very thankful. You're very thankful.
And there is clear demand for his new skills. Michigan's Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth estimates a shortage of 18,000 nurses in the state by 2015. Barbara Redmond, dean of the College of Nursing at Wayne State University, noted that the school is seeing a wide range of people transitioning into health careers, including those from manufacturing.
Well, besides their age and their experience, they bring discipline. They bring certain kinds of knowledge. Auto workers now are very into computers, as you know, and so is healthcare.
Sometimes I'll go into the patient's room and you'll see and they'll think you're the doctor. No, I'm your nurse for the day.
32-year-old Timothy Henk is the former Ford worker who took a buyout that included $15,000 for 4 years to go toward education, which he used for nursing school at Wayne State. He now works in the critical care unit at Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, Michigan. Henk says he makes less than he did at Ford, but could not be happier in his job.
Can't believe I'm doing this. Before working at Ford, it was a lot of the same old. My position a lot of times was the same thing every day. Now coming into nursing, I don't know what to see. I don't know what to expect. Every day is a new day.
Henk said about 12 out of his graduating class of 48 students were men. And on occasion, he says, his gender becomes an asset.
I'll actually had to step in a few times where I've had to take over patients from women because they got along with a male a lot better.
We're just checking your blood pressure. Checking your blood pressure. How you doing? Okay.
Back at Sheffield Manor, Kurt Edwards says it didn't take him long to get a job after getting his nursing license, but it did take a couple of tries. For his first interview, he showed up in a T-shirt and casual pants, handed over his nursing certificate, and was politely told, thank you, see you later.
Remember, I hadn't interviewed for a job in a long time. So then I went and did it the proper way. I put the shirt and tie on and went out and did it the right way.
And Sheffield Manor Administrator Lakeisha Bell pretty much hired him on the spot.
You expect to see a male doctor. You don't expect to see a male nurse. They are like a hot commodity. See, a male presence actually helps us in the facility.
At 5 feet 9 inches, 220 pounds, Edwards can lift patients as easily as he stacked heavy boxes. But he is indeed still a rarity. Although specific numbers for licensed practical nurses are hard to come by, a 2008 survey by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services showed just 7% of employed RNs are men. Bell noted that new nurses coming from the manufacturing sector had some unusual adjustments to make.
You come from making parts to taking care of people. And the whole concept with parts is repetition, but these are not parts, they're people. It changes your whole culture of thinking because really, you're about to deal with somebody's life.
And that cultural shift goes both ways. Edwards' direct supervisor, Yvonne Gibson, noted some adjustments on the part of herself and her nursing staff.
Kurt is not an ugly man, okay? So you got all these female workers and they're all looking at him like, oh, potential husband. Okay? So, yes, it does change what's going on.
At that point, she was rendered speechless with laughter when Edwards slipped a 20 into her pocket.
There's some truth to that. There's a lot of nice-looking women in this field, so you kind of have to recognize that you're here to work.
While these success stories point to opportunity for laid-off workers, Michigan's unemployment rate is still 9%. Edwards knows he's one of the fortunate stories. Sure, he worked hard to become a nurse, but he's also lucky to have found a job, especially one that he enjoys.
You know, I wake up every day and I'm very proud of, you know, I'm looking in the mirror, I'm happy, I'm proud, I'm saying, you know, this turned out great.
You can read the rest of the Comeback Chronicles at our website, marketplace.org. Thanks a lot for listening to Remarket. Somebody else will be doing this edition next week. Thanks.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.